So we'll be looking today at 2 Kings. And in particular, remember from last time we were noting how that there were many great improvements. The vicious Athaliah was dead, and the Davidic line was restored, and the city was at rest. All those things you could see in 2 Kings chapter 11. But all is not well. So we will begin now in 2 Kings chapter 12. Notice in the seventh year of Jehu, Jehoash became king, and he reigned 40 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Zebiah of Beersheba. Jehoash did what was right in the sight of the Lord all the days in which Jehoiada the priest instructed him. But the high places were not taken away. The people still sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. Now notice the basic setting here in verses 1 to 3. It began in the seventh year of Jehu. So that helps you place in your mind where it is historically with the other kingdom. Remember, Jehu was up there in the north cleaning house, cleaning out the house of Ahab. And so this king reigned for 40 years. His mother was Zebiah of Beersheba. And so he had a mother that was not part of the northern kingdom. And he did right as long as Jehoiada was instructing him. That has an ominous sound. It's certainly good to do right while someone is instructing you in the right things. That's good to do right things. But when it says he did that as long as Jehoiada was instructing him, there's a hint that something is going to be drastically wrong. And also you have that things are not like they should be because the people still sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. And so many times people think they can serve God partially. I mean, God will certainly be pleased if we do 75% right and then we do 25% of how we want. You know, when you operate in that kind of mode, you are setting yourself up for disaster. And then Joash did something that was good. Apparently, when you look at verses 4 through 16, you can see that he had the initiative in repairing the temple. That was a good thing. And notice, he commanded that the general offerings be used to repair the temple there in verses 4 and 5. He said to the priests, all the money of the dedicated gifts that are brought into the house of the Lord, each man's census money, each man's assessment money, and all the money that a man purposes in his heart to bring into the house of the Lord, let the priests take it themselves, each from his constituency, and let them repair the damages of the temple wherever any dilapidation is found. So that was good. Let's use that money for that. Well, at his 23rd year, verses 6 to 8, the repairs had not been made. Now that doesn't mean there was 23 years between the time he said, let's repair, until this happened, because it was probably much shorter than that between those two points. But then he made some administrative differences that brought success to the temple repair effort. You see, when there was a general collection, nothing was happening to the temple project. And it could be that by the time the general expenses were met and the maintenance of the priests, and then there was nothing left for building. So Joash changed the procedure. And he changed it to focus on a specific project, namely the repair of the temple. And then money began to come in. People knew where the money was going. And so they had this chest, verse 9, which they put beside the altar, and anybody that came in, they could put money in for this project. And so this idea is confirmed by the fact that in the earlier procedure, the Levites did not hurry to do the repair, 2 Chronicles 24, verse 5. And also in 2 Chronicles, you have that Joash made specific proclamation that the tax of Moses be used for temple repair. That's in 2 Chronicles 24, verses 9 and 10. And so the money that came in was not used to make worship vessels until the building had been finished. And you can compare 2 Kings 12, 14, and 15 with 2 Chronicles 24, verse 14. However, trespass money was continued to maintain the priests. And you can see that in verse 16. in this chapter in 2 Kings chapter 12. That brings us to the threat of Hazael, king of Syria. Verse 17 of 2 Kings 12. Hazael, king of Syria, went up and fought against Gath and took it. Then Hazael set his face to go up to Jerusalem. And Jehoash, king of Judah, took all the sacred things that his fathers, Jehoshaphat and Jehoram and Ahaziah, kings of Judah, had dedicated, and his own sacred things, and all the gold found in the treasuries of the house of the Lord and in the king's house, and sent them to Hazael, king of Syria. Then he went away from Jerusalem. Now, notice what we have here. Hazael of Syria took Gath, one city, and then he's threatening Jerusalem, and so Joash bribed him to go away by emptying the treasuries of the temple and the king's house. Now, that shows a gigantic lack of faith. Now, you have the death of Joash in the last few verses of the chapter. Verse 20, his servants arose and formed a conspiracy and killed Joash in the house of the Millo, which goes down to Silla. For Jozachar the son of Shimeath and Jozabad the son of Shomer, his servants, struck him. So he died, and they buried him with his fathers in the city of David. Then Amaziah his son reigned in his place. Now notice he's killed by a conspiracy of his servants, but it's not that they wanted the kingdom for themselves. They just wanted to get rid of him. And so they buried him with his fathers in Jerusalem, and Amaziah his son reigned. Now let's look at Joash's life. Part of it was good. It says that he did what was right in the sight of the Lord. And he took initiative in repairing the temple and correcting the delay in repairing the temple. Those were good things. It's good to do what's right in the sight of the Lord. That's always good. Even if a person does it for wrong motives, it's still good to do what's right in the sight of the Lord. Now, if you do it with wrong motives, God will deal with you in relation to your motives. But it's still good to do right things. And taking the initiative to repair the temple in disrepair, that was good. And then correcting the delay, that was good. But notice something very ominous. It says in verse 2, he obeyed God all the days when Jehoiada instructed him. That tells you that something was drastically amiss. And he was doing what Jehoiada was saying, but he hadn't really internalized it, it seems. And then he was faithless in the face of adversity. He gave away God's treasures to appease Hazael, lest he come from conquering Gath and attack Jerusalem. Now, to get added perspective on this, we turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 24. There is a hint of failure on Jehoiada's part. Again, you have that Joash was 7 years old when he became king, reigned for 40 years. His mother's name was Zebiah of Beersheba. Joash did what was right in the sight of the Lord all the days of Jehoiada the priest. You have that hint there again. But then Jehoiada also failed. It says Jehoiada took two wives for him, and he had sons and daughters. Now, there again, you could even see that Jehoiada was not employing God's highest standard of what God had ordained from the beginning of creation. But he set his heart on repairing the house of the Lord, gathered the priests and so on, and that account has a little more detail than what the one did in Kings. But then what we're particularly interested is what happens in verse 15 and following. It says, Jehoiada grew old and was full of days, and he died. He was 130 years old when he died. You might wonder, why is that important? There is no record of anybody living to an age that great since the days of Amram, the ancestor of Moses. So this man lived much longer than anyone else we have a record of for hundreds of years. He was 130 years old when he died, and they buried him in the city of David among the kings because he had done good in Israel both toward God and his house. Now notice what happened after this. Joash's folly after the death of Jehoiada, verses 17 to 19. Now after the death of Jehoiada, the leaders of Judah came and bowed down to the king, and the king listened to them. Therefore they left the house of the Lord God of their fathers and served wooden images and idols, and wrath came upon Judah and Jerusalem because of their trespass. Yet he sent prophets to them to bring them back to the Lord, and they testified against them, but they would not listen. Notice that the chief men of Judah, that means the important men, the leaders of Judah, came and seduced Joash away from God after the death of Jehoiada. And he listened to those advisors. That's proof that he had not really internalized fully the principles that Jehoiada taught. He had lived long enough with Jehoiada, worked with Jehoiada, listened to Jehoiada long enough to have internalized those things. But once Jehoiada was dead, these other men came and whoosh, he just listened to them. And the result was that they left the temple, the very temple that Joash had insisted on repairing, and they served wooden images and idols, verse 18, and because of that, the wrath of God came on Judah and Jerusalem. Not only that, but they refused to repent. You know, the test of what a group is made of is not whether some bad thing happens in the midst of the group. It is the response of the group to that bad thing. And you see, God sent prophets to them and rebuked them and called them back to the Lord, but they would not listen. So that shows the utter moral corruption of Judah, both in leadership and in people. In fact, when you glance at verse 20, the last part of the verse, it is very obvious that God had forsaken the nation before it was obvious. In other words, it was before that Joash murdered Zechariah. You see, it's not just once he murdered Zechariah, God had forsaken. The Spirit of God came upon Zechariah, verse 20, the son of Jehoiada the priest, who stood up above the people and said to them, "Thus says God, why do you transgress the commandments of the Lord so you cannot prosper? Because you have forsaken the Lord, he has also forsaken you." Now notice, Zechariah said that before he got stoned, obviously. And so God had already forsaken them as a nation. That reminds me of Samson. Samson was forsaken by the Spirit of God when it was not obvious to him. And that happens over and over and over. That people gradually, they depart from something God has said. They refuse to listen to the Spirit of God. And eventually, the Spirit of God quits talking to them, and they don't even notice it. Now, notice the audacity here. Verse 21. So they conspired against him, and at the command of the king, they stoned him with stones in the court of the house of the Lord. Thus Joash the king did not remember the kindness which Jehoiada his father had done to him, but killed his son, and as he died, he said, "The Lord look on it and repay." Notice his gross ingratitude. He murdered his benefactor's son who opposed him. Now, this is a contrast to David. You remember David was a man after God's own heart, and David did something that was very wicked. He committed adultery with Bathsheba and then arranged for the murder of her husband and then covered it up by marrying this woman. And Nathan the prophet came in and said, "You're guilty." And David said, "I have sinned." He repented. And so the audacity of this, notice he commanded that they stone Zechariah in the court of the temple. Why is that significant? The temple had been his own place of safety as an infant. And now he turns around and kills the son of his benefactor in the court of the temple. The temple was a sanctuary. Righteous leaders avoided executing wicked people at the temple. 2 Kings chapter 11, verses 13 to 16. Athaliah was in the temple, you know, when she heard about the commotion. And Jehoiada said what? Take her out of the temple and kill her out there. Don't let her be killed in the house of the Lord. And so look how Joash hasn't internalized principles. He turns right around and violates principle after principle. And not only that, he commanded stone him with stones. That was the death for heretics. You remember? If there was someone who needed to be killed according to God's law, then you should take him out and stone him with stones. In other words, all the people participate in this, not just the executioner. And stone him with stones where? In the court of the house of the Lord. Now, this shows the utter audacity and utter corruption of Joash's heart. So what is God's immediate response to this? Verse 23. So it happened in the spring of the year that the army of Syria came up against him, and they came to Judah and Jerusalem and destroyed all the leaders of the people from among the people and sent all their spoil to the king of Damascus. Now notice that. They destroyed all the leaders from among the people. What's God saying by this? I noticed what happened. These leaders came and they seduced this king into departing from my way, and that's what they set for the nation, and so he had special destruction for them. Incidentally, that focus on the leaders there forms an inclusio with the leaders in verse 17 who came and seduced him. And what we have is an emphasis on the judgment of God on these leaders. But not only that, notice that they are forsaken by God. A large army is delivered into the hand of a small band of Syrians. 2 Chronicles 24, verse 24. Not only that, Joash was wounded, and then when he's recovering from his wounds, he's on his bed, and he's killed by his own servants who only want to get rid of him. They are not conspiring to take the kingdom for themselves. Verse 25. You see there it says, verse 25, and when they had withdrawn from him, for they left him severely wounded, his own servants conspired against him because of the blood of the sons of Jehoiada the priest, and killed him on his bed. So he died, and they buried him in the city of David, but they did not bury him in the tombs of the kings. These are the ones who conspired against him: Zabad, the son of Shimeath, the Ammonitess, and Jehozabad, the son of Shimrith, the Moabitess. Now, there's something interesting here. Not only was he assassinated by men who did not want the kingdom for themselves, but it specifically names the mothers of these assassins, and they were an Ammonitess and a Moabitess, both of whom point back to Lot with his incest with his daughters. Do you see how God orchestrated this thing in a way that it shows God's utter displeasure with Joash? Now notice God's legacy of disapproval. He was not buried with the kings, and that is a contrast, a marked contrast to Jehoiada. Jehoiada wasn't a king, but he was buried with the kings. Jehoiada acted as a king in the Davidic sense. He wasn't the king, but he acted like one. And he guided Joash, and he did good for Israel. And so he was buried with the kings. And interestingly enough, in Matthew's genealogy of Christ, Joash and his son Amaziah are not mentioned in that genealogy. In other words, there are things like that that God has put in his word to emphasize that he was greatly displeased with Joash. And let's think about this a little bit. Joash was providentially removed from the evil influences of his parents. He couldn't help it. This woman came in, killed off all of his brothers, and he barely escaped. And so he is hidden away someplace, raised by the godly Jehoiada and his wife. But it was to no avail. It shows the importance of individual choice in aligning your heart to God. And I think this sheds light on Proverbs 22:6. Proverbs 22:6 is often glibly quoted by itself. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he'll not depart from it. And sometimes people even claim that is a promise from God. It's a guarantee that if you do your job right, your child is guaranteed to turn out right. Well, now, clearly, Joash was taught in a godly way. And it's clear that Jehoiada taught his son, Zechariah, to be godly. But Zechariah internalized it, and Joash did not. And notice, Joash did obey as long as Jehoiada was alive. He did not rebel, even though he had the power to do so. But he departed afterward. He made his own evil choice. Now notice Joash's major accomplishment. He repaired the physical temple. That is his major accomplishment. But he did not deal with the heart problem. Not his own heart, nor his people's heart. Notice also that Jehoiada made a covenant with the people and the boy king to be faithful to God. We saw that last week, 2 Kings 11, verse 17. And the account that we've seen today shows that this covenant was absolutely ineffective. It was not effective with the people, and it was not effective with Joash. Jehoiada lived 130 years, and we have no record of anyone living that long since the days of Amram, the ancestor of Moses, which you can read about in Exodus 6, verse 20. Why did God do that? God gave a long time for external instruction to happen, demonstrating that without a heart change, it is hopeless. So many times people think if we just clean up the outside, then that's the important thing, and we hope the inside changes too. And God gives us this huge object lesson in history to let us see that Jehoiada instructed this man, and he followed Jehoiada's instruction for year after year after year after year. And then, when that external thing was removed, he immediately went into utter corruption. If there is not a heart change, it is hopeless. So many times we're inclined to think, well, yes, but this is going pretty good. If there's not a heart change, it is not going pretty good. So what can guarantee future faithfulness? The answer is absolutely nothing. Our only hope is to daily turn our hearts toward God. And to daily draw near to God, and he will fulfill his promise to draw near to us. The contrast is, forsake God, and he will forsake you. 2 Chronicles 24, verse 20. You know, I think this has a lot of implication in relation to churches. One of the implications is in relation to public altar calls. Now, I'm not saying it's wrong to have a public altar call. But many times people get into some kind of emotional fervor, and then, well, let's have everybody come front that really wants to follow God, as if that is really going to make it happen. It's going to make it stick. It's going to make it work. I think when people do that, they should remember this chapter. Now, again, I'm not saying it is wrong to do that, but just remember what you're dealing with. The thing you really want is the people to go away so smitten in the heart that they will follow God and make a decision for God and do that decision day after day after day and continue in it, not some public, wonderful, dramatic, marvelous seeming display. Now, I think this account is a classic example of God's higher thoughts. Remember in Isaiah chapter 55, God says, forsake your own ways, forsake your own thoughts, and take mine instead. Why? Because my thoughts are higher than your thoughts, and my ways than your ways, and my ways work. And what does God call for all the time? It is an inner transformation of the heart. He says, I am sick of all your offerings and your fatted beasts and all of that. Who told you to come trample my courts? That's what he says in Isaiah 1. I want the transformed heart. And so what has God done? Imagine if you were living in this period of history, and here is Jehoiada, and he's doing all these things that are good, and he's instructing this king, and the instruction is good, but the king is not internalizing it, and the people are not internalizing it. And as soon as he passes off the scene, it reverts toward wickedness. What is God doing here? His higher thoughts made an object lesson for centuries for us to pay attention to, that the people who were living at the time when that thing collapsed would have thought, what in the world has been going on? In other words, God allowed that to continue, gave Jehoiada a long lifespan to have this fellow instructed and instructed and instructed and instructed and instructed, and had Jehoiada also instructing his own son, and his own son internalized it, and Joash did not. You see, if we are only concerned about external behavior, it is hopeless. Now, obviously, we need to be concerned about external behavior because you will never have evil behavior that is not driven by an evil heart. There's always something bad if there's evil behavior. But we've got to get it straight. Simply correcting the behavior is not enough. Now, notice how God allows things to go on for a long time. Instruction that was good. External actions that were good. Oh, it looks like we're making great progress. So that he can create something to give us wisdom. And then when he removes that godly influence, the one that was truly godly, then it shows what things really were like. That is to help us understand reality. And Jesus said, "Fear not, little flock. It is the Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." Why did he say such a thing? Because the number of people that are truly going to be saved is going to be a very small percentage. That's why. And this kind of story illustrates it for us. So the lesson we need to learn is, follow God with all your heart. You continue to seek him. You don't rely on your spiritual heritage or the nurture of your parents. It's important to learn from the nurture of your parents. Don't throw it away. But build on it. Go farther for God than what they went. So many people think that, well, we're doing pretty good. Just think about Joash. Just think about the people of Judah. They were doing pretty good for a long time. And they were glad to give money for the repair of the temple. They rejoiced to do it. And the people that were repairing it, they didn't have to do an accounting because they were faithful. Doesn't that sound great? Is that good? Yes, that is good that they had that kind of faithfulness. And it is good that they rejoiced about giving money for that project. Those are all good things. But remember, that was not enough. And so many times, we're content with just external things being right. Now, it's important that those external things are right, of course. But if it's just that the external things are right, and you're rejoicing in those external things, and the heart isn't really right, you're not in good shape at all. And this chapter is to help us understand that. More and more, I see the great value of understanding and studying biblical narrative. For next time, study chapter 13 of 2 Kings. And I think you can see by now, it's worth taking a glance at the companion chapter in Chronicles. So keep that in mind. All right. Do you have more discussion on this? I think maybe it's worthy more discussion. That little hint in there about Jehoiada giving him two wives, I mean, obviously they had the mentality of the society that if you're king, man, you can have lots of women. And so, I mean, he's king now. Let's make him a real king, you know. We'll give him two wives. It's very easy to be influenced by your society around you and incorporate that influence. And I guess one thing that's been impressing me so much in recent years, last couple of years, is the importance of really developing and feeding an appetite for the things of God. We're inundated with the things of the world, and especially with electronic media these days, inundated with endless distractions. You know, you've got to say no to that stuff and deliberately spend time in the Bible instead, or you will have a corrupted mind. I'll guarantee you, you'll have a corrupted mind. It's not maybe. You will have a corrupted mind because you won't be hungry for the things of God. Plain and simple.